WMCHD3 Detroit, KMPS HD3 Seattle, WBMX HD3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
This is Intuitive Soul and Friends with Lori Houston and some of the best co-hosts and fascinating topics of consciousness available. Shift Happens with Chandler David Watson, Tracy McBurney's Incredible Energy Consciousness, Mikael Mears' Financial Consciousness, and nuclear physicist Thomas Campbell with Quantum Physics and Consciousness. It's an incredible mix of the best teachers on consciousness on every show. Call Intuitive Soul and Friends now.
248-545-SOUL.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
Hey, good afternoon. It's Intuitive Soul and Friends. Today's the last Friday of the month, so we have Thomas Campbell with us here today. Tom has written a trilogy of books called My Big Toe, and he can be found on the web at mybigtoe.com, but you have to put hyphens in between. So it's my-big-toe.com. Or you can just Google his name, Tom Campbell or Thomas Campbell. He has an extensive wealth of knowledge. He has hours and hours and hours of video footage that you can look at on YouTube. He offers a lot of information that you can access for free, and he has a forum on his site that goes through even more details of questions and answering information. I can never say enough about Tom. I'm always pleased to have him on the show. This is going to be a fascinating show. We're going to look at love consciousness. We've gone through Valentine's Day. We had a show back in December where we sort of touched on this topic, and we felt that we didn't quite give it enough. So we're gonna really delve into it. It may even take another show. So I'm just warning you, there's a lot of information that's going to be going down. We're not even going to have our first break until halfway through the show. So with that being said, hi, Tom.
Hi, Lori. Thanks a lot for having me on your program again.
You're always welcome. So tell us about love. Tell us about how, I guess it's really about relationships and the dynamics between the relationships.
Yes. Well, of course, love is, you know, we talked before about relationships and kind of came to the conclusion that most of our relationships are need-based and not love-based. That we tend to fall in need rather than fall in love, and our relationships tend to be more like contracts. You do this for me, I'll do that for you. You know, you serve my needs, and I'll serve your needs. And that's sort of the understanding that most people have in a relationship, that it's a trade. It's, I don't know, I'll do yours if you do mine, kind of a trade and an agreement. And that's very, that's very different than a love-based relationship. A love-based relationship is entirely about other. A need-based relationship is about self. It's about your needs and how you get your needs met and what you have to do to get your needs met and what's expected of you to get your needs met. And a love-based is about the other person. It's about, solving the other person's issues, about serving their needs, not about your own. And it takes two to make a bargain, to make a deal in a needs-based relationship, but it really only takes one to love. Love is about giving, not about taking. So you look at where's the direction, where's the vector of this relationship? Where's it pointing? If it's pointing to you, if it's about you, then it's not love. It's need, it's ego, it's belief, it's something else. But if it's pointing from you out to other, if it's all about other, that's where your motivation is, then that's about love. So we talked first on, about relationships. And then the idea was, if most of us do have this need-based relationship, as well as some love-based relationship, then most of us have really a combination. It's not that it's an either-or. It's a sum of each. And we want to take the part that's need-based in our relationship and move it more to the part that's love-based in a relationship. So I think in most relationships, some of it is about other, and some of it is about self. So how do we move? And I gave a little you know, some recommendations, I guess, on how people can do that. And I started with saying that that the guy needs to take the initiative and be in charge here, and he needs to make sure he's focused on making his woman happy, that is, satisfying her needs, not thinking about his own. So we said, well, you know, if there's an argument, then, you know, she's right. In other words, don't argue, because argument has to do with ego. You know, it's, I know more than you do. I'm right, you're not. You know, this is all about yourself in comparison to other. It's an issue. So when I was saying these things, what I was really talking about was a way to move from a kind of an ego-based, a need-based relationship to a love-based relationship. And I think a lot of guys got confused because they thought I was telling them to change from men into puppy dogs, that they should just, you know, be slaves. And, you know, if their woman says, you know, go in the corner and stand on one foot, you know, they would say, yes, ma'am, and, you know, go do that. That's not what I was getting at. It wasn't a power. We're not talking about power struggle here. We're talking about interacting with no ego. So when I said, guys, you need to be in charge and take the initiative, I meant that, you know, it's, you still have to be in charge. And you'll see today, if we get far enough into this fundamental male-femaleness, and what does it mean at the basic level, we'll see that one of the things that your woman needs from you is for you to be in charge, for you to be able to provide for her and protect her and basically take charge of what's going on. So you have to take charge and under your initiative see that she is always happy, that her needs are met. So if you have to wait for her to tell you what to do, it doesn't count anymore if you do it, you see. You need to do it on your own before you're told or before it becomes obvious. In other words, you need to think, what can I do to make her happy? Now it's about her. So if you base that about her and not about you, what you want to have happen, now you've transitioned it to a love relationship rather than a need or ego-based relationship. So that was the point, and I just wanted to go back and touch that because a lot of guys were kind of confused. I got all of these real silly questions, right. Like, you know, if I'm talking to my lady and she says that Ireland is the capital of Britain, you know, should I just agree? And I'm thinking, oh no, you know, you've missed the point.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the idea. You know, the idea is to interact without your ego leading. So now that we've kind of done that, what I'd like to do today is to explain some of the fundamentals behind that. So what we just talked about was kind of a practical application of how do you fix the relationship. And I said that, well, the ladies are generally insecure. They need you to lead that process. And when you give them enough security by making it about them and they feel that that's real, then they will be able to then start growing and they will return the same thing. It will become about you. They will be able to give, you know, openly and freely once they have the security of that kind of situation where they know from your viewpoint it's all about you. You see? So it's not that just the guys do this, but it's a process wherein both people end up interacting with motivations about giving other happiness, about meeting others' needs rather than their own. All right, so why is it that, you know, the ladies tend to be a little insecure about that? Well, there's a good reason for that. You know, our culture and our fundamental programming create that kind of insecurity, and we'll talk about how that comes about. Okay, that's just one for the ladies, but we'll see here what the programs are that drive males and females, and they're different programs, and we'll see why they're different programs. Okay, so we'll start with, you know, what are the criteria for physical evolution? So we're going to go back to when people were first on the planet. Maybe they were Neanderthals, you know, maybe they were Cro-Magnon man or something, but as the human species was just getting started, from then up until, say, the last 5 or 10,000 years, You see, it was a very, very, very long time. The last 5,000 years is like an eye blink in the history of our evolution. It's just almost the present, you see. So when you're talking about such a long evolutionary period, most of our evolutionary programming was written or was created, you know, a million years ago. So we have to look at it in a little deeper context than we normally would. Okay, so survival and procreation are the two criteria for evolutionary success in this physical reality. Okay, now, since one must survive in order to procreate, these two criteria are actually entangled. Their combined criteria is forwarding one's genes in the gene pool. Okay, so if you get to forward your genes in the gene pool, that means your progeny, your children carry your genetic material and they go forward and they survive and they procreate. And then their children survive and they procreate. That's the kind of your optimum genetic contribution to the species, as if your genetic material goes forward. Now, of course, if your material is strong and positive for the species, then it should more likely continue than if it's defective and, you know, not too survivable or, not so able to procreate, then that dies out after a while. So that's how these genetic codes are written. It's not that the people sat down and said, all right, what sort of program, you know, should we do? It's not an intellectual thing. It's just that over time, what works continues and what doesn't work goes away. That's just the nature of evolution. So now what does this have to do with male and female? Okay, what does this have to do with our sexuality and our attitudes and the way we feel? Well, there are these, you know, I'll call them genetic programs, but now you know what I mean by program. You know, it's just what has evolved because it works, because it optimizes our species ability to continue. So our species survives and it has to procreate to do that. So that's this, each individual's mission really is to forward their genes in the gene pool. Okay, that is what gives our species the optimal probability of success. All right, and that's generally agreed by scientists as the evolutionary imperative for all life forms in our physical reality. That is, lions, tigers, and bears. You know, no, they have the same kind of evolutionary imperative. Each is to try to forward their genes in the gene pool. Probably even true of plants and other things as well. They also evolve in the physical reality. Okay, well, males and female humans each have their own strategy, okay, that's evolved genetically over millions of years. Okay. Now, let's understand the context of this evolution. Our evolution has taken place over millions of years, and all but the last eye blink in time were very, very harsh. Shelter and food were hard to come by. Survival was problematic. Lifespan was about 35 years. Puberty occurred like 17 to 18 years. Kids were more or less independent and carrying their own weight very early. Life was simple and straightforward. There was little social stratification. Everybody was more or less in the same boat. You see, we didn't have the social stratification that we've had in the last 5 or 10,000 years. Nobody went to work, you know, and worked 9 to 5, got a paycheck, and came home. You know, everybody was pretty much in that same boat. There was very close intra-tribal relationships and cooperation, because that cooperation was essential to both survive and for successful procreation. Women probably outnumbered men, as they do today. And, this situation that I've just described is the situation for which we are genetically programmed. And we still carry that program, even though our culture now is very different. And often a lot of our problems and issues in relationship and in dealing, with our lives here these days has to do with the friction between our cultural programming, okay, which is different, I guess, from culture to culture around the globe. You know, that's kind of current programming. And our genetic programming which was developed over these millions of years of evolution of our species. Now, there's this asymmetry between males and females. That means ways in which they are fundamentally different. And two of these asymmetries in particular are important in this in creating this genetic program. Okay, one is in physical body size, and the other one is in sexual function. Okay, and this asymmetry leads to different strategies for forwarding one's genes in the gene pool. Okay, the two sexually related asymmetries are that women are physically smaller and weaker than men, and men impregnate the women, and the women have the babies. Okay, pregnant women and women nursing and caring for children are less able to take care of themselves and their children if they were not pregnant or did not have children. So they need some help to get by. It is these two asymmetries that create the different evolutionary strategies. Okay, so first let's take a look at the males. Just look at the men and see what, you know, what are the strategies, what things could males do in order to, you know, have the optimal probability of forwarding their genes into the gene pool. In other words, having children that then go on to have children that go on to have children. So they have to be survivable and they have to be healthy and strong, right? So what could men do to optimize their own strategy? Well, the first thing they could do is just a numbers game, okay? Have sex with as many physically attractive women as are available to him, period. Now, let's go back and see what attractive means. In this case, it's kind of what I'd call, you know, a low standard in the sense. We'll see there's kind of two standards here. And that is that basically good physical and genetic health. Okay, that's what attractive means. We know that, you know, men and women are attractive to each other for several reasons. And one is that what's called symmetry, physical symmetry. You know, eyes, you know, you have two eyes and they're, you know, they both look the same but are on opposite sides of a center line. You know, that kind of geometric symmetry in the body is a good sign, a good indicator of good genetic health. Plus, of course, you can just look at somebody and by, you know, the way they stand and walk and skin tone and act and so on, whether they smile or frown or whatever, gives you a sense of their overall general health. So those two things are what, you know, we're describing as attractive. Okay, good genetic health and good physical health. Okay, so that's one thing that the man can do is basically try to have as many children as possible with the idea that, well, just because you have a whole lot of them, then you have a higher probability that some of them will survive and carry your genetic material on into the future. Okay, the second thing they can do is secure the highest quality available woman to invest in, pair bond, okay, with as many physically attractive, high standard, physically attractive females as possible. Okay, now, when I say as many as possible, pair bond with as many as possible, you think a pair is just two, but you figure that a male could forward his genetic material better if he could pair bond with, you know, with as many as he could. But as it turns out, one is really as many as he could. You know, it's very difficult to, in this time when this genetics was being done, it was very difficult to come by enough resources just to stay alive and deal with the things you had to deal with. That one is really the number. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Okay, because he has to ensure the survivability of this female or females and the survival and success of their offspring. Because if the offspring don't make it, then his genetic material doesn't make it into the future either. Okay, now this pair bond implies that he, because of his investment, expects her to limit her sexual activity to him. You see? And he will take care of her and her children. Okay, he's looking for a woman who commits herself to him, thus strengthening the genetic value of pair bonding. Okay? That's because he doesn't want to invest his resources and time in protecting this woman and her children if she's having somebody else's children. That's his investment, you know, to forward his competition. And that's not what he wants to do. So that would not be, you know, that genetic program would fail and it would fall out of the evolution. It wouldn't work as well. All right, so now look at the logical consequences for males. We'll kind of summarize about the males. Okay, he wants to find women who will have sex with him and then later find an attractive woman with good reproductive potential who will accept him as her mate. He's hardwired to initially see women as sex objects, but also, at the same time, more as he matures, is looking for quality worth committing to and investing in. Also, after the children are sufficient, after the children are self-sufficient and no more are on the way, the original point of the sexual programming ends, but the programming continues forever. And this is males and females. The same program runs from basically the day you're born until the day you die. It doesn't, like, doesn't go away. Now, notice that this genetic program was written at a time when people didn't live past about 35. And now that's not even quite midlife. Mm-hmm. So you see there's a big difference between then and now. Okay, now one might think that a male would theoretically do better genetically if he could support and protect several female mates who remain faithful to him, okay, father more children to carry his genetic material forward, right? However, the resources to provide for and the ability to protect were very difficult to deliver, okay, at that time. Even if that problem were solved, it is likely that such a man would end up investing some of his resources to boost the genetic success of his competitors. In other words, he would be taking care of children who are not his. All in all, the practical difficulties and risks make the potential benefits extremely unlikely. Because there is no significant practical advantage to such arrangements, there is no genetic imperative for or against this alternative. Okay. Now, men are attracted to, are pushed by their genetic programming to have sex with any attractive female who might make herself available to him. Also, men do feel responsible to protect and take care of their wives and children. They expect their pair bond mate to limit her sexual activity to him to protect his investment. They are somewhat competitive with each other to attract who they consider the best choice for mate, but since they choose firstly on the criteria of satisfactory physical attractiveness, remember that was physical health and genetic health, they usually have many potential choices. Men have a need for their women to demonstrate to them that they are valued as a sexual partner and as a good provider, protector, because that validates their success at and their value. That validates their success at accomplishing their genetically driven mission. See, that's what they're supposed to do. Okay, now note that though it's easier and less complicated to have a single woman satisfy both strategies, right? The two strategies were one, have sex with every woman that you can, and two, find a pair bond with a good quality woman so that you can protect her and the children to make sure that they survive and get a chance to carry your genes forward. Okay, so those are the two criteria. So it's easier and less complicated to have a single woman satisfy both strategies. However, there's no evolutionary hardwire requirement to do so. Thus, having a wife does not conflict fundamentally or with having a lover. All right. Now, let's talk about the ladies. What's the kind of the basic sexual programming that evolution has given them? And again, they're still carrying the same program now, even though our culture's changed dramatically, and you carry it from birth to death. Okay, now the females don't have just two strategies. They have three strategies. That just figures, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. The first strategy that they would have in order to make sure now that they can forward their genetic material forward in the future, okay, they would want to bear the most survivable children, right? They need to bear children that are very survivable. Okay, so how do they do that? They need to secure the highest available quality sperm. They are sexually attractive. They are to be a sexually attractive to men in general and induce the one that is most attractive. Okay, that means has the best quality sperm, means most attractive. And in this case, there's two criteria, not just the one criteria. They have the same criteria as the men, which is good physical and genetic health. But besides that, they have another criteria, is a man who would produce offspring with the highest survival success quality. Okay? So let's go back and get this sentence again without that big parenthetical phrase. Okay? Their strategy is to be sexually attractive as possible to men in general and induce the one that is most attractive to have sex with her, thus optimizing survival success of her offspring. Okay, so that's her first strategy. Second strategy for her is form a pair bond with and remain attractive to a highly survivable, successful, and reliable male, so that he will take care of her and protect both her and her children for the long term. Okay. Pair bond implies to her that he commits to her and to her children, that he thinks she is special, that is, he is committed to her and will put her above and ahead of other women and other women's children. Okay, so that's her second strategy. Third strategy is she has a numbers game as well, and that is have as many healthy and well-cared-for children as is practical and as conditions allow. The more children she has, the more likely some of them will survive and go on to spread her genetic material forward. Okay, now some of the logical consequences for women. Yeah, a little summary here. She must find an attractive man, one with good reproductive potential, and a man with good provider and protector potential. She is hardwired to be attractive, at least superficially look like a sex object, to use that female power to secure both superior quality sperm and protection and support for herself and her children. Also, after the children are gone and no more are on the way, the original point of the sexual programming ends, while the programming continues forever. And you might think of, when that kind of mismatch occurs, you might think of midlife crisis, emptiness syndrome, those sorts of things. Okay, she's looking for a man who commits himself to her, thus strengthening bonding. So we see there's a couple things that kind of push us toward a pair bonding mentality, but they're not specific, just the pair bonding. Okay, now one might think that females and their children would do better if they could have several males cooperatively taking care of and protecting them. However, males find it genetically counterproductive to invest in other males' offsprings, and she must meet all of their needs and keep the peace, maintain that cooperation. You see, males tend to fight, which could be a steeper downside than an upside of such an arrangement. So there's more actual risk than potential benefit. Because there's significant practical advantage to such an arrangement, there's no genetic imperative for or against this alternative. Okay, note that though it is easier and less complicated, it's more convenient to have a single man satisfy strategies 1 and 2. Okay, 1 and 2 were, as you recall, 1 was, be sexually attractive as many men as possible and then induce the one that is most attractive to have sex with her, thus optimizing her survival and success of her offspring. And 2 was form a pair bond with a man who will, take care of her and her children. Okay, those were the two strategies. Okay, so it's easier and less complicated if she has one man satisfying both strategies, but there's no evolutionary hardwired arrangement to do so. Thus, having a husband does not conflict fundamentally or primally with her having a lover. Okay, interestingly, the evolutionary strategy drives both sexes to directly want and require a commitment from their mates. Okay? He wants a commitment that she will be sexually faithful to him because he doesn't want to invest his time and resources in other men's genetics, and she needs commitment that he will stay and take care of her and her children. Okay? So they each have a commitment on the other. Okay, thus that desire, expectation is part of their programming. But there is no direct evolutionary advantage for either sex to have or keep a commitment to their mates other than pleasing or keeping their mates. So that's the only thing. But that's that motivation is driven by circumstance rather than direct genetic programming. So thus, its secrets could be kept. There is no direct genetic evolutionary penalty for, that means no direct primal programming against, either sex having a lover.
Wow. This is fascinating. We do have to go to break, but wow. This is very interesting. It leads, I can't wait to continue this conversation. We have Tom Campbell with us today. He can be found, well, Google his name, because he can be found, you can actually even download through Google his books. He can go to YouTube, you can go to his website, mybigtoe.com, but there's hyphens in between, so my-big-toe.com. I can't say enough about Tom. This is a fascinating conversation. I can't wait to get back from break. You're listening to Intuitive Soul and Friends on Sky Radio, powered by CBS.
Feng Shui for the Soul. CBS Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries. NewSkyRadio.com.
Something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done for me is to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah. The darkness has a hunger that's insatiable. And lightness has a call that's hard to hear. And I wrap my fear around me like a blanket. I sail my ship of safety till I sank it. I'm crawling on your shores. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than questions pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find. Yeah, closer I am to find. Yeah. And I went to see the doctor of philosophy with a poster of Rasputin and a beer down to his knee. Never did marry or see a big great movie. He graded my performance. He said he could see through me. I spent 4 years prostrate to the higher mind. Got my paper and I was free. I went to the doctor. I went to the mountains. I looked to the children. I drank from the fountains. There's more than one answer to these questions pointing me in a crooked line. And the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am to find. Yeah. Closer I am. Line. And the less I seek my source for something, it is closer I am to find. Closer I am to find. Closer I am to find.
CBS Radio's The New Sky.
Back to Intuitive Soul and Friends with Lori Houston. Call Lori now.
248-545-SOUL.
CBS Radio's The Sky.
The Sky.
Welcome back. This is Intuitive Soul and Friends. Tom is with us every last Friday of the month, so do stay tuned because I do believe this is definitely going to have to be another show where we discuss this even to get all of the information that we're going to be discussing. All right, so.
All right.
All right.
Is this like drinking from a fire hose?
You know, oh, yeah.
I've been pouring out a lot of information, man. Sentence or two has a lot of information in it that you'd have to think about for a while and see, well, how does this affect me? But I'm just going on and on and on. So I hope that all of the listeners have good memories and are taking notes or whatever, because this
they can also listen to it again.
Yeah, it's a little hard to follow all this much so quick. But let's kind of do a summary about the women. Okay, the women are driven. That means pushed by their hardwired genetic programming to be as sexually attractive as possible. That is, want men in general to want to have sex with them. That does not mean that they want men in general to have sex with them. It means they want men in general to want to have sex with them. Two very different things. While they reserve the right to be able to choose who and when. Women are very competitive in their sexual attractiveness to get and keep a man. However, physical attractiveness is only half and the lesser half of the attractiveness criteria that they apply to men. More importantly, they also rate men on their internal and external personal power. That is, a man who will father more survivable offspring and be a better provider. You know, what might those criteria be? Well, initiative, taking charge, strength, brightness, intelligence, confidence, social status, pecking order among peers, ability to provide and protect, physically fit, athletic, independent, aggressive, gumption, resourcefulness, competency, a plan for the future, ambition, knowledge, potential to accrue necessary resources, as well as depth of character, empathy, and sensitivity. Women have a need for their men to demonstrate to them that he is committed to her and see her as special and valued, particularly above other women, thus validating her success at accomplishing her genetically driven mission. Now, today, a minority of women, particularly young women, immature women, often have trouble translating their hardwired sense of attractiveness from the cave dweller days to the apartment dweller days. Attributes such as aggressive, domineering, independent, secure, physically big, strong, wealth, social status, political power, and that political power could be at the office, at home, or in the community, potential or actual financial power, or simple popularity, like singers and movie stars, may singly or in combination ring genetically programmed bells that turn out to be dysfunctional in today's culture and have no relationship to either personal power or quality of consciousness. Occasionally, by confusing attractive personal power with arrogance, confidence, bluster, and indifference, many young women filter out the nice guys with real personal power and are attracted only to jerks, jocks, and hotshots, self-centered, self-promoting manipulators who know how to manipulate female hardwired genetic sexual programming, generally losers and duds with high opinions of themselves. High-quality nice girls and high-quality nice guys are not into manipulating others to this extent because they want valuable relationships, not simply the ability to use another person to satisfy their needs. All right, so here we have a million years of evolution. Attitudes, approaches, and ways of interpreting and dealing with the world. Okay, I'm just going to mention just a few, and mostly about the women. Each may apply to a subset of women. So when I say, women this, women that, of course, all women don't feel the same way. You know, the females have a genetic programming that runs all the way from one pole to the other. You know, some females have a lot of masculine attributes. Some men have a lot of feminine attributes, and we have this continuum, from one pole to the other. So I'm just talking about what's under the fat part of the curve here. In other words, what is most common, kind of typical, if you will. about averages, because there's always exceptions when you talk about, you know, men. You can't say all men are this way or all men are that way, but most men are this way and most women are that way. That tends to work. Okay, men now, because of their programming, master the outside world. Okay, they provide for and protect their mate, their children, then their self. What's key to them is teamwork, cooperation. Interaction primarily with the outside environment requires a lot of focus and attention to outside details. Okay, now we talk about the hunters and gatherers, and that the men were the hunters and the women were the gatherers. And I think that probably was not true for most of the time that this program was being generated by evolution. I think most of the time it was everybody was hunting and gathering. Every time they found something that was worth gathering, you know, they did that. And hunting wasn't really the big deal, I think, for a long time. It was more just protection. Okay, it was more of a soldier mentality than a hunter mentality that was required. Because you can imagine these people didn't have a lot of stratification. You know, there weren't a lot of hierarchy in their social structures. There weren't things like, marriage. You know, there was just people, you know, ended up together, and they could come and go as they pleased, and there weren't rules. There weren't so many social rules as there are now, but when people disagreed, they basically settled it with violence. So that's a little different. Now, I say that men have to focus and so on. You know, we know that men tend to have one-track minds. You know, they can sit and focus on the football game and not hear anything else that's going on in their environment. You know, you almost have to, you know, tap them on the shoulder or tap them on the head to get their attention, because focus is part of what they do. Whereas females, they master the inside world. Okay, that's the relationship building, networking. Okay, they get by, they do better if they have a network, a set of relationships. Okay, if something happens to them, if they were to die, get sick, or meet with a violent death, they would want other women to care for their children. Now, that would expect these other women to invest their resources in forwarding some other woman's genetic material. But if you're good enough friends, you see, if you've made relationships, then they can override that programming. So relationships are very important. Okay, they juggle the competition and personal connections through cliques. Again, relationship. Interaction is focused on inside environment relationship. Parallel processing spreads focus over many tasks. They have a lot of things to do all at the same time, so they can easily parallel process lots of things, and the guys cannot. So we see that females apply their intellect to the inside environment and get by with charm and assistance in the outside environment, whereas men apply their intellect to the outside environment, that is, manipulating the outside world, and they stumble or feel their way through the inside environment. So you see, the men are basically working on intuition at the inside, at the relationship environment. They're not using their intellect for that. They use their intellect on the outside environment. Women do the opposite. They're applying their intellect to the inside environment and that relationship, not really so much to the outside environment. Now, obviously, both apply some intellect to both. You know, again, we're just talking under the fat part of the curve. We're not being absolute here in any of these statements. We're just kind of generally trying to catch the substance of what's going on. Okay, well, there are a lot of cultural consequences, right, that are different for, you know, men and women, like fidelity issues. See, that's a cultural thing. As we said, that's not hardwired. That's a cultural thing. Expectations and roles are different for males and females. Limitations that we put on males and females, like, well, men don't cry and ladies don't belch in public. You know, you just don't do those things. Well, that's none of that's hardwired, obviously. That's all just cultural. Fashion is all cultural. Also, different value is given to men and women by our culture. And differing cultural values, like taking charge or being nurturing, you know, drive gender behavioral expectations. So now we have a couple of facts. We'll see where some of these implications lead. Two facts. We have a male-dominant culture. That's just a fact. The great majority of males and females are very much fear and belief-driven, insecure, immature, and lots of ego. That's another fact. Okay. Those two facts then interact to provide a whole lot of mischief, and we'll talk a little about that. There is much cultural-derived fear around both relationship and sexuality, and much of that is created by the dissonance between our genetic programming and our cultural values. But because ours is a male-dominant culture, this fear takes a much larger toll on females than males. Women are confused. For example, the culture tells them to be hot, hot, hot in some roles, not, not, not in other roles. Because of our cultural image of women, now again, that's an immature, egoic male cultural image of women. Our culture sees women as sex objects who take care of children and do domestic work. Women are culturally undervalued by this lopsided view. Women, of course, know deep down that they have personal value, personal quality beyond this limited vision. The result is that in our culture, women form an underclass whose personal worth is not fully validated by male-made cultural feminine stereotypes. Cultural beliefs are absolute and are accepted at the being level. We don't question these cultural beliefs. So this creates an identity issues and self-worth issues, and for many, leaves a systemic low-level tension between the sexes, because any underclass resents being an underclass, even if they fully accept the situation as natural, you know, the way it should be or just the way it is. This tension, on one hand, creates a subtle subconscious chip-on-the-shoulder attitude, a non-specific uneasiness, and less than total trust and appreciation of men and their cultural dominance, a fear of being used or taken advantage of, a wariness, all usually simmering beneath the intellect. So these aren't intellectual feelings often. This is going on beneath the intellect. On the other hand, it also creates identity confusion, self-worth issues, feelings of inadequacy, and insecurity. Insecurity creates fear, a fear of being too hot and too cold, of being not exactly whatever it is a female should be, a model that is only shallowly provided by the culture. The value of being female is defined in our culture primarily in terms of a female's expected services to others rather than in terms of her individual quality of being. Fear creates anxiety and ego reactions from don't tread on me to I am only good for treading on. Confusion, all rolled up into an undefined stress and anxiety. So women feeling insecure and inadequate for reasons that they cannot quite put their finger on. Okay, many eventually make an accommodation with their culture and their men, but the solution never quite feels completely right or complete. Something they learn to live with. A sizable minority of women now begin to feel bad about themselves. One may counter feeling insecure and inadequate by trying to be perfect, which may lead to an ego need to be perfect. Being a perfectionist must lead to failure, since no one can be perfect, which reinforces one's feeling of failure, feeling bad about oneself and feeling inadequate. It's a vicious downward spiral ending in great distress, personal dislike, that's defined as depression, and a prescription for Prozac. Why do so many more women than men take depression medications? See, this is a cultural issue. Okay, so that kind of leads us through some of the very basic programming and how these programs reflect in our culture. and how we have these cultural overlays. Now, let me first make the point that these programs are just genetic programs. It's how we are programmed to feel about things and the way we are. But it doesn't mean that we have to abide by them. We have free will. We can make choices. We're in charge, and we have the responsibility to be who we want to be. So this, oh, I couldn't help it. That's what my genetic program made me do. Like saying, the devil made me do it. Well, that's not a good excuse. You're in charge. You have responsibility. You need to, do it right. This genetic programming will change, but it only changes very, very slowly as we change, as we, modify the program because different things don't work now that used to work. They're no longer in our advantage or no longer for our disadvantage. That's what we do when we take charge and don't just succumb to being automatons following our programming. You see, we can do better than that. So I didn't want people to think that this is, this has to happen. This is how our inclinations are, what makes us go, how we value and kind of do things, our motivation, the nudges, the pushes we get from our genetics, as opposed to the nudges and pushes we get from our culture, are two very different things. And if you understand where your genetics are pushing you, a whole lot of things in your life that are confusing and are causing you trouble tend to evaporate because now you see where they come from. And you don't have to say, what's wrong with me? Why do I feel this way? What's wrong with him? Why does he feel that way? You realize that it's the way we are at a very deep level of our genetic material. So we're running close to time, and I expect to hear a little
bit. We actually we went through the one break. We've been given some extra time without some breaks. So we've got about five more minutes, almost. This has been really fascinating because it's given a lot of thought. I almost don't know where to ask the question because there's so much that this is going to come out, and which is why we will definitely do another show on it. But I guess helping us understand the commitment difference, you've explained it sort of, but let's kind of go in a little bit more detail because women seem to want a commitment on one level, men want a commitment on a different level, and it's interesting how they don't really match necessarily.
Well, none of this really necessarily has to match. What it is, this is how males and females can most successfully get their genetic material to move into the future.
Right.
You see, they can contribute to their species. So that's what's going on. Made as a cooperative must fit. It's made as a success for the species. This is how our species optimizes its success as far as surviving and procreating and going on as a species. So this tension that we have is part of the price we pay for optimizing our species. You see, so yes, the men have this requirement for the ladies. They want commitment from the women to be faithful so that they don't end up putting their resources and investing in another man's children. And the women want their men to commit to taking care of them and their children. You see, it's different kinds of commitment. But they both want commitment in a relationship, but what they want from the other is different. And also, neither one of them has any genetic programming that pushes them to basically honor the commitment on them. So there's no genetic programming that says the female, what you need to do, female, to make your genetic material optimize its progress forward, is to be faithful to the man. She does not have that. That's his want from her. He wants that from her, but she doesn't really have any genetic reason to do that. And it's the same with him. She wants him to commit to her, and he says, well, I really don't have any genetic reason to do that. So the reason that they come together and stay together are two. One, they both have this thing for a pair bond because it's more survivable for the children if somebody's there to take care of them and see that they survive. Otherwise, the children have be very unlikely to survive in that harsh of an environment if they were just on their own, you see.
Yeah.
It happened. Nobody's genetic material would go on, and the species would flounder. So that's, you know, so they both want that commitment to a pair bond, but they want it for different reasons. But neither one really feels driven to actually meet the commitment that the other wants of them, except as to keep the pair bond together so that they do end up with survivable children because somebody's taking care of them. So it's a practical reason for them to stay together, not a genetic reason, you see. So that's kind of an interesting thing, but you see how all this works. And like I say, the program goes on forever. So if you're an 80-year-old woman, you're still putting on, you know, lipstick and, you know, doing your hair and doing makeup, you know, and somebody may look at you and say, why is she doing that?
I do that to my mom all the time.
She's doing all that trouble. But you see, that's just programming. That's what her genes tell her she needs to do and be. And that program doesn't stop just because you're, you know, 85 or 95 or 105. Makes no difference. No, you're not going to have more children. No, you're not having babies that somebody's going to have to take care of and you need a man to do. All of that's gone, but we still run the program. And the same with the men. You'll have a 90-year-old guy and he's looking at the fold-out in the, you know, in the Playboy magazine. And he's interested in it. They're thinking, why? You know, what is it with this guy? But that's just the way men are programmed. You see? So.
Okay. Well, can't wait to re-listen to this show. And now Tom will be back on March 29th. We will definitely finish this conversation and talk a little bit about, you know, the dynamics. I want to go over the intuition stuff again because it's all fascinating. I love this. So thank you again, Tom. This is a fascinating conversation. Find out more about Tom at his website, mybigtoe.com, but hyphens in between, so my-big-toe.com. Go to YouTube, Google his name, get as much information as you can. He is definitely worth researching and finding and listening to all the wealth of information that he has available, has made available to everybody. Wow, Tom, thanks. You're listening to Intuitive Soul and Friends on Sky Radio, powered by CBS.